Our first speaker is Martha King. She's a 20-year veteran of the National Conference of State Legislatures and is currently the Director of Health Programs. She has a very rich and varied background. She has a master's degree in public administration and a master's degree in social work and a bachelor's degree in biology and psychology. Now, her interest in policy began early in her career when she worked in the Legislative Council in the Colorado General Assembly, and her interest in health also began early in her life. She served in the Peace Corps in South Korea, supervising a rural county tuberculosis control program. She's written about 20 different papers on health policy on topics like Medicaid, health care reform, children's and maternal health, and the state children's health program. Martha tells me she has very fond memories of Wisconsin because her grandparents lived in Minnesota. And one of her favorite things to do as a child was to drive across the St. Croix River to Wisconsin to get ice cream. And I think we can be assured that this is more than just paying lip service to the dairy state. She even has a cow worked into her presentation. And that's not an easy thing to do when your topic is Medicaid in a nutshell. Thank you for coming, Martha.
Good morning, and it's a pleasure to be here. Let me check this microphone. Is that working fairly well right there?
Are they hearing?
My job is to give a Medicaid 101, and I have to tell you, I'm quite intimidated. I walk in, and I'm supposed to be talking to you all about Medicaid. We've got Representative Kurt Gelo sitting back there, and your Medicaid director over here, and Dick Sweet, and Charlie Morgan, and Marley Moore. So I just want to know, are there any questions? Who am I to be doing this? And we've got two real national experts here. I know enough about Medicaid to be good at cocktail parties, and that's about it. So I really am intimidated by you all. Here's how I feel. While I can explain the meaning of life, I don't dare try to explain how the Medicaid system works. But at NCSL, we believe in being concise and right to the point, and so I've got a one-pager here that describes Medicaid. So if you all memorize that, you'll be in good shape. Anyway, I am delighted to be here, and again, I'm to do the overview. Well, why should you all care about Medicaid? Well, it's a big chunk of the budget, for one thing. On the average, it's about 22% of the average state's budget. It represents about 43% of the total federal allocations to states. It's a huge federal investment. It pays nearly half of U.S. nursing home costs. It covers nearly a third of the U.S. population over the age of 85. I mean, that was a stunner to me a few years ago when I realized that. And over a third of U.S. births. And this reminds me of Shakespeare's Seven Ages of Man, where at the beginning of life and at the end of life, this program really has become society's funding for services. It also subsidized care for the uninsured and a subsidized graduate medical education, so it's a big program. Medicaid is the 800-pound gorilla in terms of state appropriations for health. It represents close to 70% of all state spending on health. Medicaid at a glance, well, it's a federal program. There are 55 variations of it in terms of states and territories. It's optional. A lot of people don't realize that this is not a federal mandate. This is something states can choose to opt into or not. Once states opt into it, you have quite a few federal mandates about who you cover, how you cover them, et cetera. But the reason all 55 states and territories participate is it's a huge federal financial incentive. In Wisconsin, and I want to thank your fiscal bureau again, excellent paper they had back there, more than $2.7 billion in federal money comes in between your medical assistance, your Badger Care, and your senior care. And your Wisconsin matching rate is really quite generous. The lowest a state can get is 50%, but in Wisconsin, you're close to 58% of your medical services are paid by the federal government. In Colorado, we're at right at 50%, and of course, the legislature complains about that quite a bit. Medicaid really is three programs in one. It's become a health insurance program for low-income parents, mostly mothers, and children. About two-thirds of your Medicaid enrollees in Wisconsin are children and mostly moms. It's become a funding source to provide services to people with significant disabilities. I've begun calling Medicaid the nation's high-risk pool. These are folks with substantial disabilities and chronic illnesses, and of course, they must also be low income. And it's become the nation's long-term care program. It really subsidizes Medicare in that way. Medicare for the elderly pays very little long-term care, and Medicaid has become the federal program that people tend to lean on. Perceptions of Medicaid were the two diametrically opposing perceptions. One is it's a black hole. It sucks in everything around it. And you can kind of see that when your Medicaid budget rises by 12% one year and your general fund rises by 1.5%, something like that. It really has begun chewing up other parts of state budgets and the federal government. Another view is, wow, look at all the money we can get from Washington. Let's milk this cash cow, you know, and go ahead and cover more people who are uninsured. And New York does this very well. New York knows how to milk that Medicaid cow. About a third of its total budget is Medicaid. I'm not saying good, bad, or indifferent, but that's kind of the views, and a lot of people are kind of in between those two. So who does Medicaid cover, and what does it cover them with? Again, the program is not a federal requirement, but once you adopt the program, you have certain federal requirements you have to meet. Medicaid is an entitlement to individuals. That is to say, anyone who meets your state eligibility criteria must be covered. You can't just shut the door and say, gee, we're going to put you on a waiting list. Of course, there are exceptions to every rule. There are waiting lists, but that's another slide. Under the federal law, states must cover certain people. Charlie and in the fiscal report shows you who Wisconsin covers under both your mandatory and your optional populations. The mandatory categories primarily include certain children up to 133% of poverty, pregnant women and families with income up to 133% of poverty, people on who receive SSI, which is a federal Supplemental Security Income program based on income and disability. You also have a number of options to cover people. In Wisconsin, you cover pregnant women and children up to 185% of poverty, and you can see the rest of the list in this wonderful report that you all have by the Fiscal Bureau. In terms of services, again, the federal government requires you to cover certain services, including things like hospital services, nursing facilities. So here's your nursing home coverage is actually a mandatory requirement under the federal government. You also have a number of optional services that you can cover. Some people are surprised to learn that prescription drug coverage is actually an optional service, but programs find that it's such a valuable medical service that all 50 states and the territories and D.C. cover that. I want to note here that for children under your Medicaid program, even if your state plan chooses not to cover certain optional services under Medicaid, you must cover those services for children if they are deemed to be medically necessary. So there's another exception for you. You also have your Badger Care program, which really is sort of an extension of Medicaid, plus the Children's Health Insurance program. Is that, Charlie, is that a 1115 waiver program, the Badger Care? It's 1115 waiver. We'll talk about waivers in just a little bit. So under this Badger Care, the state covers additional children and families. So it brings in the two-parent families, is that correct, as an option under Medicaid and your children's health insurance. And you average about 94,000 people per month is what the report says. Okay, then who's not covered? Well, everybody else. You have about 500,000 people in Wisconsin who don't have insurance. Any person who doesn't meet the eligibility criteria for the program, and a lot of these categories of people are people call this categorically eligible for the program. If you are eligible for SSI, the Federal Supplemental Security Income Program, for example, you qualify for Medicaid. If you have a disability, you can't work, but you don't qualify for SSI, you probably don't qualify for Medicaid. So you could be a single male making dirt, I mean nothing, and have health difficulties, but not meet the qualifications for Medicaid, no matter how poor you are. This slide represents, on the left, the percentage of enrollees nationwide in these various categories, and on the right, the expenditures attributed to them. On the left, you'll see that about 75% of people nationwide in the program are the moms and kids, a few dads in there. Elderly, about 9% of the program, and people in the disability category, about 16%. Now, in Wisconsin, you've got a little bit different numbers. The moms and kids population is about 67%. Your elderly population makes up about 16% of your population, so it's nearly twice the national average. And that's an expenditure that makes the Wisconsin program a little bit different. On the right, you can see the expenditures, and it's almost reversed, where the moms and kids are really quite cheap. They make up about 30% of expenditures, and the people with disabilities and the elderly make up close to three-quarters of spending. Why is this? So it's the long-term care budget. People who qualify based on their age and disability tend to be in nursing homes or other long-term care programs, and you can see how that's represented on this bar chart. Understanding the cost, that's what makes Medicaid so expensive, is this sort of high-risk pool feature and the long-term care feature for people who don't have long-term care insurance or their resources to take care of their own needs. And the kids and families are relatively cheap. They need primarily preventive and primary care. We did allude to waivers a little bit earlier. To every rule, there's an exception. Over the past several years, Medicaid has become more and more flexible in terms of getting waivers from the federal government to be able to cover virtually anyone a state wants to. So that a number of states have actually expanded their Medicaid programs to cover families up to 275% of poverty. The most generous state out there was Tennessee, that went up to 400% of poverty to really use Medicaid as an anchor for their health care reform to cover more people. Now, the train wreck happened in Tennessee with their budget, and they're having to scale that way back, and they're really going to be pushing people into safety net providers and beefing up that system. There's a new twist out there. Utah, are you all familiar with Utah's 1115 waiver? It's really kind of interesting, I think, where, of course, the Medicaid director would be, where they've expanded Medicaid to cover adults who wouldn't qualify otherwise, up to 150% of poverty, but in their program they cover only preventive and primary care, with the idea that if you actually get people and meet their primary care needs, hopefully they wouldn't need as much hospital care or show up in the emergency room as often. There are specialized waivers out there. Wisconsin has a senior care waiver to provide prescription drugs to certain people who meet your criteria. And there's a family planning waiver, which I understand Wisconsin has now, to provide family planning services to women and capture them before they get pregnant and if they don't want to have children. And then supposedly that will save you some money to help women who don't want to be pregnant. There's new flexibility, as I said. The federal government, under the Health Insurance Flexibility and Accountability Initiative, really is partnering with states to be able to expand access to more people. The target population under these HIPAA waivers is families up to 200% of poverty. What are the pros and cons of expanding your Medicaid program? A lot of states have looked at that to say it has been far and away the most effective public policy to cover more and insured, bar none. It's not that there aren't some other options out there, but except for employer-sponsored insurance and trying to shore that up, expansion of Medicaid and CHIP has been the most effective in covering people. There's a generous federal match. You have an existing provider and administrative network. There's new flexibility out there. Is it better than nothing for the 500,000 uninsured? Representative Gilo doesn't think so. He's got a plan there on the table. We'll be very curious to see how that comes out. If Wisconsin does this, we'll be talking about that in other states all over the country. The cons of expanding Medicaid, well, it costs a lot of money. You'd be pumping more state money into it. There's a political philosophy. What is the appropriate role of government? Should government be taking on everybody who doesn't have health insurance? There are federal mandates. If you do expand Medicaid, you have to abide by the federal mandates. And there's a potential maintenance of effort requirement where Congress could come back and say to you, once you've expanded to this population, in order to do something else, you're going to have to continue covering them. So some states have experienced that. Cost-saving strategies. I'm really going to flip over these because this is Vern Smith's talk. He's going to talk about what states have been doing to cut costs. But I have to at least put a couple slides in here about beware of the unintended consequences, because my motive is to show you this cartoon, which is we have a plan that will save even more money. So you let open the doors of the state mental hospitals, and where do they go? Unless there's some other place to take care of people, they may end up in some of these other places. So it's not as though the illness goes away. They're going to pop up somewhere else. Another thing that I'm more and more interested in is how much of our health care funding, including Medicaid, goes to so-called futile care. We all believe that we don't have to die. Americans really think that we are immortal, and we are in denial about this. And how much money actually goes into extending a life for a very short period of time. And I'll use my own father as an example. The slippery slope, of course, is defining futile care, for whom is what futile. My father had congestive heart failure, a mild heart attack. Turns out he had lung cancer. He was on Medicare. Medicare would have been glad to pay for a quadruple bypass, would have been glad to pay for lung surgery. The man was 85 years old. So as a family, we said, why would we do this? This man has lived a good life, and why put him through this, let alone Medicare? I ride a bus with a man who was gone for a couple of days, and he came back, and I said, Joe, where were you? Well, my wife's grandmother had a heart attack last night, and it's really touch and go, and they resuscitated her two times last night. This man's my age. I'm thinking, your wife's grandmother, how old could she be? He said, well, she's going to celebrate her 100th birthday next month. And so I wanted to say, gee, you know, I'm really sorry you're going through this, but I blurted out, why would they resuscitate her? How many nursing home patients do you all have who do have a do not resuscitate order that the nursing home isn't abiding by? In Colorado, we found that we had quite a few who had a do not resuscitate order, Medicaid, and the nursing homes were bringing them back to life. They're real cheap. They don't complain. They're unconscious, you know, and you get some money for them. But it's an argument that this society is going to have. I'll get off my soapbox. Yeah. And it's okay, futile care for everybody else, but not for me and my family, right? Cost-saving strategies, again, Vern Smith is going to go through this, but I guess I would... The one point I want to make is simply cutting people and cutting services aren't the only strategies that states can use. You get some of these other cost containment issues going on. The problem is most of these other reform efforts take time. So when you have to balance your biennial budget, it is tough. And sometimes you feel your back is up against the wall. But as you do this, and this is my excuse for this slide. I love this one. A couple of guys sitting in the bar. Are you just pissing and moaning, or can you verify what you're saying with data? It's very, can you say pissing at a family impact seminar? I'm not sure. It's a first. But when you're going to do something, know what you're doing. Use data. There's evidence-based medicine out there. There's data out there. And John Hollihan is one of the nation's great people related to data, so use him. Chronic illness and disabilities. How much could be prevented before people become eligible for Medicaid? What, as a society, what are some of the illnesses and so forth? By the time a person gets into your Medicaid program under your SSI definition, they're pretty darn sick. They have pretty serious disabilities. Where are they in the pipeline to help prevent that? And, of course, some of that is your public health initiatives, other access initiatives. But I was reading in your the nice clippings you all sent, and thank you very much. There was an article that appeared in the Wisconsin State Journal that talked about your really, really, really high-cost Medicaid patients last year. 15 of those were premature newborns with an average cost of $559,000 apiece. It could be that some of those babies, there was nothing you could do to prevent that. They were in neonatal intensive care, but were any of those babies such that appropriate care to the mom would have prevented that from happening? I think that's a big question. You have another 35 people who cost more than $500,000 a year, and who are those people? Some of them certainly need the care, but are any of those sort of in the futile care category? I don't know. There's high-value preventive services. Are you getting what you pay for in your Medicaid population? Are your pregnant women getting care? Are your kids being screened for conditions that could help them? What's your immunization rate like in Wisconsin, et cetera? Are you getting what you pay for in your program? So you face opportunities and challenges. Many states are feeling very, very challenged these days. But what is your Medicaid program supposed to do? What are your goals related to health in Wisconsin? Do you want universal coverage? Do you want universal access to care? Do you want a healthy population? Do you want employers to play more? Do you want more personal responsibility? And then once you decide what it is you want to accomplish, what is the appropriate role of your Medicaid program? What is the appropriate role of government in what you're doing? And are you getting what you pay for? And how can you control and not shift costs? So with that, thank you, Karen.
Okay.
We're going to take about 5 minutes of questions for Ms. King, and we must ask that you speak into the mic. The person on the mic is Heidi Normandin, who's our state policy coordinator for the State Family Impact Seminars and for our Policy Institute for Family Impact Seminars. We are audio taping, and the purpose is some legislators travel long distance at the Capitol and like to have an audio tape of the seminar. So our purpose here is to give state legislators an opportunity to ask questions of our national experts, and I'll try to give as many legislators and high-ranking state agency officials as possible a chance to ask a question. So any questions for Ms. King? Yes, Representative Gilo.
No.
It's a softball, Martha. With your significant experience around the country, Martha, you talked about the Utah waiver and its uniqueness. Can you talk about any other states, any other initiatives you see going on elsewhere in the United States that impress you as to dealing with the issues that you so well?
Good question. You know, there are more and more ideas out there about how to craft the program. Vermont just had its waiver approved to actually establish a global budget. It looks an awful lot like a block grant to me. So that will be an interesting one to watch. Missouri just sunsetted its Medicaid program, which means come 2008, the program will disappear unless they do something radical to reform it. And I think it was sort of a threat out there as we can't do business as usual. We're going to kind of zero base budget and say, what is it that we want to craft in our program? What are they doing then? Well, I think the intention is to really take it seriously and do some reforms and go ahead and continue the program. I can't imagine really letting that stand. But they want to take it very seriously and start from ground zero instead of tinker around the edges. Most states are tinkering around the edges of 3 or 4% of the budget in there. Some very interesting ideas coming out of South Carolina and Florida related to using health savings accounts for some of their optional populations where they would actually give an allotment in an account to certain people. And I just listened to a presentation by the South Carolina Medicaid director, and when the governor was first proposing it, it sounded like it would be much more global, but once they got into that, they realized that there are certain people for whom this simply wouldn't work, but they hope to test that and run that up the flagpole.
Are you all hearing okay? Okay, another question for Ms. King? Yes.
This area where you mentioned the resuscitating the person at 100, isn't that a little bit dangerous to start thinking along that line? Pretty soon it pulled down to 90 or maybe 80. I know one time a physician told me that everybody has the desire to live. And yet if they haven't signed that, don't resuscitate, what is the people in the health field supposed to do? What's the physician's, they got some sort of a, help me out, Mr. Benedict. What's the pledge you take as a physician?
The Hippocratic Oath.
Well, you might say do no harm, and then you've got to define what's harm. Are you saving somebody? Or are you prolonging a death? That's where, and we've started. I'm on the Medicaid Reform Committee, and we have with Representative Gillo, we have some suggestions, and one of the ones that I proposed, I'm a retired neurologist, so I've dealt with end-of-life issues quite a bit, and that is to try to get people to express their wishes before there's a crisis so that you don't have the default. Right now, the default situation is to resuscitate just about anybody if they haven't made their desires known. The plan or the hope is to get everybody at some point when they are decisional to make that type of end-of-life decision. One suggestion is when you enter the health field, or not the health field, when you take out insurance, when you enter Medicare, Medicaid, that you are given the option, not necessarily required, but given the option of signing an end-of-life decision or appointing a healthcare power of attorney. So that's how I would respond to that.
And I think that, yeah, I would echo that response. As I again, the slippery slope is who defines what is futile care. But I think your point is so well taken, is if people and family members have more information and are counseled by the medical community, and you can get some ethicists to come in and talk to your commission. Oregon did this. Oregon did a really interesting long-term community input with ethicists about what services do we cover, and ended up cutting out organ transplants, certain organ transplants that didn't show the evidence in terms of effectiveness. And they took an awful lot of flack when some poor kid died. His name was Colby Howard, and then the headlines are the state kills Colby Howard, basically. But in the meantime, you don't have headlines of Oregon covered, you know, 30,000 additional pregnant women and how many infants were saved as a result of that. But I think, you know, the state probably shouldn't be defining what is futile or not in terms of definition, whether we're going to give you that service. But you could certainly say what you're going to pay for or not, and you certainly could look at educating consumers and their families. Because, you know, if it's my dear old mom, I'm going to feel really guilty if I don't do everything possible for mom. But if the state would help me realize that what is everything possible, and why would you simply prolong her life when she, you know, for a month or two when she's quite in quite a bit of pain, instead of let her die a more natural death?
We have about 30 seconds left.
Senator Mark Miller, the last month I was privileged to hear a presentation by Dr. Fisher from Dartmouth about where he had looked at the cost of Medicare patients across the country, and it's also true here within the state. There's dramatic differences in per patient costs, anywhere from approximately $5,000 up to $10,000, and the quality of care is really no different. Are you aware of any states that have looked at that data and tried to manage Medicaid costs as a result of looking at that data?
No, I'm not aware of any states. John Hollihan and Vern Smith may well be, but I think you're onto something there with both the difference in costs in Medicaid and also just the utilization. Is are you getting the best bang for your buck in what you're purchasing? Are you purchasing unnecessary care? Are you not getting some of the care you do purchase, say immunizations for kids or prenatal care for pregnant women? And using that kind of data, you could, certainly could be a smarter purchaser